Okay, well, I think we'll let people trickle in here, but since we're a little bit late to start, we'll kick things off. I'm Lois Parshley, and I'm an independent journalist. I've moved in between editing at print magazines, The Atlantic, Foreign Policy and Popular Science, and freelancing, and I have spent a lot of time begging for money, so this is an exciting session to have here at SEJ, and I'm going to let our panelists introduce themselves, and then each panelist will present some information, and we'll have a lot of time for Q&As. So with that, I'll let Rachel start us off.
Sure. I work at National Geographic Society, and I run our storytelling grants. Before that, I was at the Aspen Institute running a fellowship, and then in my former life, I was a photojournalist working internationally. So,
great. Hi, I'm Lisa Palmer. I'm a freelance journalist. I'm an author. My book is Hot Hungry Planet, and it's out in the lobby. I think I signed a couple of those already, and I am a senior fellow at a research center that looks at the human and natural systems. It's part of the University of Maryland, and that's sort of a part-time thing where I work with grad students and postdocs in teaching. So, I've had the very good fortune of being the recipient of some travel grants through the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, the Solutions Journalism Fund, and as well as travel fellowships through SEJ to come to these events and to support my travel to SEJ, as well as being in residence at other organizations for short-term fellowships to have more intensive learning about a specific topic. And so I'm a firm believer in using these fellowships and travel funding for professional development and sort of expanding your storytelling capacity.
Hi, I'm Rachel Rohr. I am a Knight Wallace Fellow, which is a fellowship for mid-career journalists. It's based at the University of Michigan, so I get to live in Ann Arbor for the next several months. But I'm on a leave of absence from my job, which is managing editor of the Ground Truth Project. It's based at WGBH in Boston, which is the NPR and PBS affiliate in Boston. Ground Truth is pretty small, so if you haven't heard of it, it's a nonprofit that supports the next generation of journalists. So we give fellowships to early career reporters, and we have a really broad definition of early career. So we started out giving mostly international reporting fellowships, and since the 2016 election, we've been doing a bit more in the United States. We launched an initiative called Report for America that's really interesting and has a new kind of funding model attached to it. But in the context of today, I can certainly share more about the Ground Truth Fellowships, and I've gotten some insight on the reporters that we work with. I work with them in the field. Like, I'll be based in Boston, while they're around the world, and so I can also share, some of their experiences and some other opportunities that they've gotten in addition to Ground Truth Fellowships.
So one of the things we're going to have the panelists do today is speak to a number of the different challenges that come with international reporting, whether that's the grant process itself and some of the common mistakes that people make, to what some of the building blocks are you need to stay safe during your reporting trip itself, and also the follow-up, what deliverables you might have to think about before you start your reporting so you can make sure that you're fulfilling your grant deadlines. And please do note there will be plenty of time for questions at the end of this, so hold your questions for now until we get to that point. And with that, I'll let Rachel kick us off.
Sure. So as a lot of you may have heard, a few years ago, National Geographic split off into two. And so we have our publishing branch and the society, which is the foundation. And we work in this sort of virtuous cycle where the publishing branch gives us at the society 27% of their revenue. We also get funds from other areas. And in return, they get first right of refusal for any of the products from our grantees. And we provide grants in all different kinds of areas. We have scientists, we have exploration. But it's relatively recent that we've called out storytelling in this way, in this new format. And so what we're really looking for is great stories to support. And the deal is, whether you're a photographer or a writer or working in audio, really any kind of storyteller you could imagine, you would apply for a grant for us, and we have three different kinds that I'll explain. And then if you receive funding, complete the project, then an editor with our partners gets to look at it and make the decision about whether they want it. And sometimes they say yes, and that's usually great for everybody. And sometimes if they pass on it, you can take it somewhere else. So I think it's really a pretty good deal. So I'll tell you about our three different kinds of grants. We have our early career grants, which are up to $10,000. That's for those of you who have around 5 years or fewer of experience. We have our Explorer level grants, and those are up to $30,000. That's for people who are pretty well established, who have been published quite a bit, and who are often in the ecosystem of National Geographic already. And then we have RFPs, and those are aligned with issues of priority of the society. So we have a marine plastic RFP, and often those are specific to scientists. But our main RFP for storytellers is looking at documenting human migration. Now, not all of these grants are for international work. We actually love it when people work in their own countries and document stories of their own communities. But if you do want to work internationally, we emphasize that you have to have a local partner, which is a word that sometimes scares journalists a little bit. It shouldn't. It just means that we don't like parachute journalism. We want you to be pretty integrated within the community where you're going. And we want to know that you understand these issues of safety and are going to know how to handle yourself if it's a dicey kind of situation. So I'll stop there, but I'm happy to explain more if you have specific questions about that grant process. And I'll just say the most information you can possibly get is at our website, nationalgeographic.org/grants. And I would just really encourage you to apply. I've had so many people who are wonderful photographers or writers come up to me and say, I'm just not sure if I'm ready for this yet. And there are people who I've heard of, who I say literally you're a famous person. So I think there's a lot of barriers, and a lot of journalists don't feel comfortable or ready or are just not in the mode of applying for grants, and I'm telling you that you should. So
great, Lisa?
Yeah, well, on that note, yes, you should. And I'm here today to announce I just received a new grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to have a residency for writing for a month at their center in Italy. And so I have yeah, it is. And so but it's, you know, it's specialized, but I had not heard of it before, there was no way I would have had the, you know, initiative to apply for it and get people to support me on that. But, you know, it's through these types of relationships that we're creating here with our networks of people that we're getting to know through SEJ and other journalism networks that we find out about these terrific granting opportunities. And so I have been, since early in my career, I guess one of my first grants to support my travel and funding was the Rivlin Fellowship, which is something I think that they still do at SEJ, is to get people here to the conferences. And so applying for grants for funding around in places in parts of the country that you can't normally get to, it also sort of adds to your toolkit of skills. So being able to write grants is, I think, pretty important as you want to build your career. From my perspective, that's been a way for me to find new stories and new ideas, because I'll be meeting up people that I wouldn't normally meet. So I've been supported by the various Knight centers that have had reporting fellowships, whether they're the intensive one, they used to have a Knight Center for Specialized Reporting. The Solutions Journalism Grant, I don't know if any of you were, some of the panels this morning, they're talking about the need for more solutions journalism, and so the Solutions Journalism Fund has some great reporting tools, but they also provide grants, or at least they did for a while. And I've received other grants from international reporting trips that actually didn't come to fruition, which I will talk about as well, because those are some of the challenges of that. So receiving a very specialized grant that has to be done at a certain period of time. And received grants from the Pulitzer Center on crisis reporting. And I want to make clear there that the crisis reporting sort of name, you know, title, part of the title is really meaning to cover underreported and undercovered stories. And so don't think it has to be a crisis zone for it to be something of importance to them. And I really want to make sure that you know that, because it's they're an excellent group to work with. They've just received new funding that's earmarked towards rainforests and forests globally. So, you know, if you can go on their site, they have this big Amazon Rainforest Fund that's currently happening now with other opportunities coming up. But they will be continuing to offer reporting trips abroad for that. I think for that, some of these fundings, some of these ups and downs and pitfalls of these fundings is that they can happen. You have to have reporting done by a certain amount of time. I learned of an opportunity this morning that I would really like to do, but the reporting has to be done by April 30th. And I've got actually a lot of stuff already scheduled for my spring. And I don't know when I would be able to fit that trip in. So I had a trip that I spent a lot of time planning for that I won this pretty sizable reporting grant for a couple of years ago, an international trip to Africa. And I spent quite a bit of time after working with an on-the-ground collaborator as well as a radio team that was from the UK, because we wanted to share in some of the costs, and they were doing completely different slants on stories. But they were going to some of the areas, so we're going to share a fixer and a driver, and because it was expensive, for one reason, I get all my things set up in all of my locations, and then one of the main people that I wanted to meet with, I find out sort of, you know, a couple weeks before, oh, he's not going to be there. He has to be actually in the U.S. or something. And so I'm like, ugh. And so I, you know, spent all this time sort of working with this other team to replan my trip and to the first week in December. And so I moved it from October to December. And then I told the funder that I had to switch my plan. And they said, oh, but we need to have the stories by December 15th in order to report back to the Gates Foundation, you know, which is the funder. So I had to cancel that trip. You know, I spent, you know, weeks setting it up. So there's definitely some things, hoops that you need to sort of jump through in some of these grants that you do, make sure that they're done at a certain period of time, and there are limitations about what you can cover under a certain grant. So they're great, but they definitely have some strings attached in terms of making sure it falls in these certain parameters, and if you can work that in, then it's usually a win-win situation.
Great, Rachel. So the first thing I want to touch on is safety. The Ground Truth Project adheres to something called ACOS, a culture of safety. And I want to tell you a little bit about that, but this is something that can apply to any of your reporting, not just if you do a Ground Truth Fellowship. It's something to keep in mind if you're doing international reporting or even domestic reporting, how you can plan your trips to ensure your safety or to help ensure your safety. So one thing for international trips is something called HEFAT. It's a type of training. It's hostile environment and first aid training. So that essentially prepares you to deal with various types of situations in the field, which can also boost your confidence, you know, to know that you can handle those situations if anything happens. The other thing is called a risk assessment. And so this is essentially something that you can do on your own. Helps if you have others to help you, but it's essentially something you can do on your own to research what possible risks you might be facing. So that could range from personal risks to you, things that could happen to you while you're there. It also involves some research where you can try to, you know, look around and see what's happening in that region, what things have happened recently, what issues have other people faced, and also things like natural disasters, like what if an earthquake happens when I'm there, or what types of natural disasters are possible in this place, because you just never know what might happen. I know somebody who was reporting in Nepal when the earthquake happened. Not planned, you know, it just happens. The Ground Truth Project was actually, before it was its own nonprofit, it was incubated out of Global Post, which was an organization founded largely to support international freelance journalism at a time when newspapers were cutting their international bureaus. And Jim Foley worked closely with that organization Jim Foley, as you might know, who was kidnapped and ultimately murdered by ISIS. And so safety is very close to the heart of the Ground Truth Project and our mission in supporting the next generation of journalists. And so certainly also carrying insurance, making sure that you're insured when you're reporting, so have health insurance. There's also hostile environment insurance. And you can learn more about that through Reporters Without Borders or the International Federation of Journalists. So that's safety. Feel free, if you've got any questions about safety, please ask. The other thing I want to touch on is just this idea of making your own opportunities. So whether you already have whether you're a producer at a radio station, you have a staff job, or whether you're already reporting, or whether you are freelancing, there are creative ways that you can think about making your own opportunities. One example from Ground Truth that I really love to share because it was so surprising to me, this is about our most recent podcast season, which I produced the podcast there, called The New American Songbook. So this was a series of 5 audio documentaries about immigrants and music. That project was not something that we had really planned. Two independent journalists in the Boston area approached us. They said, we have these ideas for some stories, and we know about this grant that we can apply for with this organization called Mass Humanities, which is a, I believe it's actually public, but it uses a lot of, or private, but it uses some public funding. But a lot of different states have humanities grants. And so they realized that if they could get a match in their application, they would probably get that grant. And so they said, do you want to work with us on that? And so we loved their story ideas. We felt confident in their ability to deliver those stories, and so we applied together on that grant. And the thing is, Ground Truth often offers fellowships, but we don't normally accept pitches from freelancers. This was not an expected thing. It's not something that we really had a model for, but we're open to those types of pitches and ideas, and I think a lot of news organizations are. So if you see that an organization is doing a certain type of thing that you think is cool, and you have an idea that you think they would be interested in, just because they don't have a grant that's being advertised, I would say still reach out to them about that. So we ended up getting, we matched mostly through in-kind. We got an additional match from WGBH, which is essentially our, the building that we're based within. We're technically independent from them, but we work really closely with them. Our podcast is actually a GBH podcast. So we had these 3 sources of funds coming together. Not only did we put it out on the podcast, but WGBH Radio was interested in it because some of the stories had local connections. They were really local, global stories. And also PRI's The World was interested in it. And none of these entities, our podcast, PRI's The World, WGBH Local Radio, none of these felt that we were in competition. That we could all leverage those stories. Maybe we were slightly changing them to fit our needs. But I think it's a good example of creative partnerships and not looking at different organizations necessarily as competitors, but you can all support a project and, whether it's cost sharing or maybe it's just getting paid multiple times to leverage your reporting into different stories for different outlets. If you're reporting internationally, there might actually be some interesting thread of a local connection so that you can do a version of your story for a local audience, get paid again for that reporting. Oh, and just to share, that podcast season won a National Murrow and the Online News Association Award. So that was very, very validating. And it was just a surprising thing that came together. So if anybody has questions about just creative partnerships, let me know.
Great. Well, coming off that idea of creating your own opportunities, it's pretty obvious to every working journalist that it's incredibly frustrating when the money is the thing keeping you from doing the story that you want to do, but it can be very daunting looking at the grant ecosystem to figure out which one might be the right one for your particular project or how to go about even starting an application. Lisa, is that something that you could talk to us about?
Yeah, I think I've looked at have tried to work with a number of different organizations for how you will get what you want to do, and just sort of keeping an eye. I actually have a spreadsheet on my computer that sort of has opportunities as a tab that I keep under. I have a my story. I just keep a spreadsheet of my story ideas, and then another tab is opportunities. And I just sort of come across something, and I will bookmark it there. I'll just make a line, just so that I have it all in one place. But like for instance, today I heard about some Manga Bay reporting grants that are here, and the new Pulitzer Center grants are there. Is it the FEJ fund? The Fund for Environmental Journalism through SEJ has grants. So, you know, you can continue to start compiling these lists and then looking at their specifics. You know, one will be maybe forest specific. Other ones are, marine plastic specific. You know, so understanding what areas they are and if they align with what you do or even an early career or later career. And I consider also some of these fellowships that are sort of a longer year-round or year-long duration to be also very valuable because you can then find ways to connect whatever your beat is to a larger story or find ways to localize this bigger picture. I've been finding ways to sort of navigate it through there, but also understanding what you need from them. I think one thing that makes it me a good fit for the Pulitzer Center folks is that I also like to teach, and that part of that opportunity is they have a network of campuses around the country where, so when we were talking a little bit about some of the follow-on things that are required, it's not a requirement, but if you are willing to play nice and teach some classes or give lectures and talk about your journalism to journalism students around the country and sort of make sure that that's known or you have some experience in that, you may be a more attractive candidate for them to fund because then you know that you can be a part of that potential program once you're writing your stories are reported. So they now use my stories in classrooms to teach certain either subject matters. And I'll go to a campus. For instance, I was at the College of William & Mary recently, and I did a one-day seminar, a journalism seminar for non-journalists, which was fantastic. And I was seniors, and they're just sort of getting their feet wet and sort of how do you do a story, how do you do an interview, like just the basics of journalism. So journalism 101, but it's over the course of a year, and so I was in one section of it. They have visiting guest journalists for each of their sections. But, you know, that's really fun, and I wouldn't have that opportunity, but it goes both ways, and then they pay a per diem for that. So knowing that some of the ins and outs of what they're looking for or what are some additional things that you can bring to the table, as well as, you know, being able to capture some things in your reporting that they then can use on their websites, because they often will have a page, I don't know if you do as well, like a page like our journalists in the field that we're supporting, and then have a little bit of a backstory, how I got the story, and use some of your reporting tools to sort of talk about that while you're in the field, which is can be tough. I always like, I'm trying to get the story, and I don't want anybody to have to be reporting about myself getting the story. It's, I don't know, I find it difficult to do.
And to our Rachels, Lisa was just talking about the importance of targeting a grant specifically for a project or for your beat, but from the organization's perspective, from the people who are accepting these grants, what do you look for in a candidate?
Sure. So we're looking for people with a really, really strong story to tell. In a perfect world, it's somebody who says, whether I have the money or not, I know I need to do this story, and we want to help you tell that story. We as a society are not in the business right now of giving assignments, and so we love it when you come to us with something pretty fully baked. We want to see that you've done your research. I also, one of the pitfalls that I see often is somebody who comes to me for like a, you know, $15,000 grant, and they say, I'm going to make a podcast, and I'm going to do a set of photographs, and I'm going to write 5 articles. And I'm like, okay, really? I want to see that you do one thing really well. And you may be an incredible person, but I don't necessarily trust that you are a Nat Geo level photographer and writer and podcaster, right? And so I really want you to show me that you have a body of work that shows me that you can do this. I want to see that you have a really detailed coverage plan, that you've thought through how you're going to get this story, that you have those sources on the ground and people who are going to help you tell the story well. And then it's not a way that we're not going to ding you so much, but if you want some really extra credit with us, We want you to be able to show us that you've thought a lot about impact and how you're going to collect those data. And that is one thing that a lot of journalists haven't thought very much about. But when you have, we're just like, we would love to fund you, right? So so going beyond saying I'm going to measure how many tweets or how many people have read this and saying, I have a question about whether, you know, for example, more people care about this watershed I'm reporting upon, and I'm going to do some due diligence to see if I've truly made a difference there. And so I would definitely suggest looking into finding ways to report your impact back to us, because that just helps us make our own internal case that this is important. So, and then the other piece of it that is sort of our, it's not a trick question at all because we try to be as clear as possible, but we look at the budget very carefully just to see that it makes sense, because that is telling us whether you've really thought this through and truly have read the directions, because that's the area where we have the most sort of specific directions where people often skip pieces. So I don't want to call it like a gotcha area, but it's a place where we can see that you've done your homework.
I would second all of that, certainly. I think when it comes to the story ideas themselves that you're essentially bringing to the table, because like Rachel was saying, we're not going to prescribe, you know, what the story is. You would be including that as part of your proposal for a fellowship. And I would say, particularly as it relates to environmental reporting and climate change reporting, and it really, in particular with international reporting, sometimes it's hard to get an audience to care. And so you are going to be making the case, you're going to be really thinking through, how do I get people to care about this story? Because if you can convince us, then you can convince an audience. It's not just about climate change, you know, it's climate and social. It's climate and women's issues. It's climate and health. There are different ways to look at stories through lenses that might have, that might be more interesting to an audience, and to really challenge ourselves to figure out how to connect to that audience. When we set out to do a 3-year climate change reporting project with reporting fellows, it was focused on climate change, and it was really challenging to try to come up with a really big project that would really resonate with people. And we decided to tell the stories of human impact of climate change that were already happening, because we felt that that would be a really tangible, really human way for people to care about that climate change reporting. So we told stories of the connection between storms and human trafficking in the Philippines, the connection between climate change and mental health in the Arctic, the connections between climate change and conflict and violence in Somalia. Climate and security issues. So that's just one thing I think about, you know, in terms of really challenging the reporter to make a case for why we should care about this story. Certainly, you know, having done your homework is really important. And oftentimes we end up pairing journalists together, like an outsider and an insider, you know, somebody local, somebody international, in order to help address some of the parachuting issues.
Lisa, what are some of the challenges that you faced in the variety of grants that you've applied for and then received, and what lessons have you drawn from that you wish you'd known when you started applying to grants?
Well, kind of when I opened up my dialogue here, that knowing a certain parameter of when the story had to be done or when I had to report back, if I received the grant in May, I didn't know, for instance, that it had to be done by December 15th. I didn't know there was an end date to it. I figured if I could travel before December 15th, I didn't know that the stories also had to be finished and published by then. So I'm not understanding all of those ins and outs of that. Also, the impact. That was one thing that I didn't pay enough attention to on some of my early reporting grants. Whether it's there's a lot of effort now being looked at at how you measure impact. And so I think there are ways that we can look at whether it's just increasing awareness and how you measure that, or it's coming up with the variables that are kind of specific to what you're doing. It may just be increasing awareness about a watershed, or it could be this certain policy must change or needs to sort of be brought to greater, scrutiny. But it's sort of understanding what that might be or look like and thinking it through ahead of time. The other piece is using your money wisely. Things happen and change in the field that you don't really know, and you don't often get more money as a result, and things can cost more and less or whatever. Like when I flew, and it's sort of also the risk and understanding what's happening in the country, because I was in Colombia and I had my schedule that I had set up, but everything always takes more time and you never know what's going to happen when you're in the field, and it can get, the logistics can be difficult. And so when I arrived, it was interesting that the airline pilots in country that operated the national airline were on strike. And it's really difficult to drive from places in Colombia, just how the roads are and mountains and regions. And so there are flights to everywhere, and they're pretty inexpensive. But because the pilots were also previously on government payroll because the country was at war, what peace also brought was no longer the need for the pilots to be on the National Guard. So they lost like 30% of their wages, so they went on strike. Thus, I had to take like an overnight bus down from Bogota down to the edge of the Amazon, which was difficult. It was right after, like, the day after I was interviewing somebody about how he'd been kidnapped and how police would board, or these pseudo police would board the buses in the middle of the night when he was traveling, and they'd take everybody's passports and then make everybody get off and then shoot somebody, and then you'd sit there and you'd look at the dead body out there. I'm like, oh my God. So this happened to me. So I'm like in the jungle, like outside of the town, the police in the roadblocks, out the place. But it was just sort of preparing the risk and sort of not getting too wrapped up. It was fine. I took my passport and I'm like, but they gave it back and I got there. But it was just these different kind of logistics, and that, and it was actually more interesting. I didn't get to it took up more time because I had to take that. I mean, I had to plan my day differently and add a few more days to my trip. But you just never have to be more prepared to be to adjust your schedule in the field. And I had wanted to go to one region instead, but there was actually a conflict flare up there, so I had to completely change my focus from one region, which had a completely different ecosystem, and I had to do it pretty quickly. And then, work with the editors that I had promised the story. Like, well, the story's going to be a little different because I couldn't get to this one region. And that's the type of thing that if you have somebody who's willing to kind of trust you in your reporting and your body of work, they're like, okay, she's still going to give me a good story. It's not maybe what I set out to do, but having somebody that you can work with on that is good. And I should also mention that, before being, it's sort of this tricky dance of trying to pitch your story to editors without yet having the funding, because it's this, well, we'll fund you, but you have to have 2 to 3 major markets, and not, major market or major publisher for your pieces, and we need a letter of commitment that they're going to do this. And so for the Guardian or whatever, they're like, well, how do you know if you're going to get the funding? So I'm like, it's this tricky dance. If you have to have some prior relationships, that definitely help get those, if you've got a track record, that will definitely help you get those commitments.
Okay, I will say,
I was just going to say, I'd like to add a safety thing, just jumping off of that kind of terrifying anecdote. Another thing that's important in terms of safety is if you can coordinate a daily check-in at a certain time within a certain time window. So say from 3 to 3:30, like work it out with the person in the other time zone exactly when that is going to be, and also walk through what the expectations are if you are not able to communicate within that time window. The person doing the check-in, say it's the editor, is going to know not just your emergency contact. I mean, they're going to know who are the people on the ground in the country where you are that you can reach, who they've probably seen you within the last few hours. Where are you staying? What is the name of your driver? What is his name and address? Trying to get as much of that information as possible so that if you miss a check-in, they can start basically like a phone tree of trying to figure out where you are. 9 times out of 10, in my experience, the reporter has just, ten times out of ten for me so far, because I've been very fortunate, the reporter has just been somehow out of service or unable to check in because they're in the middle of a really intense emotional interview and they don't want to abruptly end it, or they fell asleep. And everything's totally fine, but it's good to have that be coordinated, have agreement on it, and know what the steps are that happen when the check-in doesn't happen.
Do you have a follow-up, Rachel?
Yeah, I agree. That's really important. We don't do that for all of our grantees. We ask that they do arrange that, but when they don't have a backing institution, I will offer to be that person if they need that. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember what my other point was related to what you said.
The dance.
Oh, yes. Okay. So we actually don't have that situation because we have this megaphone that is National Geographic. We do ask to know if there is interest. And so if you say, you know, I spoke to a couple editors, they sounded interested in this project, but we actually, because we have this situation, you can't have a firm commitment to somebody else. Because
we want the first right.
And so it's tricky because we do want to see that you have interest and that you've had these relationships with other people, but you don't have to have a letter of commitment or anything, which is, we've heard, nice.
Yeah. And another version of that on the ground truth side, because with early career journalists, often they don't have the relationships established or the credibility established with major outlets to get that commitment. Mm-hmm. Typically with ground truth fellowships, we're not having people sort that out ahead of time. We're usually helping them with our connections and our knowledge. Sometimes we even wait until a lot of the reporting's done to think through, like, who would this be a really good fit for? You know, like, who do we know? Or sometimes we're reaching out to new people to land it in the right place.
And I would follow up with that on the earlier career piece. If you are a student or you work with students, the Pulitzer Center definitely will publish your piece on their Pulitzer Center site. So it's a great way to get clips. So they will. I think they can fund up to, I think it's $1,000, maybe a little bit more than that. I can't remember exactly what that amount is for a reporting trip. And they will publish it on their site if you can't get somebody to publish it. So that you have a good clip, and they'll work with you on that and help you find some outlets. So there are ways that you can start to build this work as an early career without having that promise. So yeah, there are certain kind of piles to that.
One final question on for people who might be earlier in their career and might not have worked with local collaborators before. You've each talked about the importance of having local collaborators, whether that's to avoid parachute journalism or to help keep you safe or some combination of all of the above. For people who haven't worked with a local collaborator or a fixer, what are some of the things that you think are important to know about that relationship and how to establish one?
Good question. We certainly have had people who have taken sort of pilot trips to go make those connections. I think now we live in this sort of golden age of journalism, which has Facebook groups for like every area, and I don't know if you've used them, but I think you can make really wonderful connections internationally in that way before you go on your trip and start to get to know people a lot. But I would also say, as an early career person, work within your own community to build clips and experience and some reporting chops, and don't be afraid that that's not sort of exciting or sexy to grant making institutions. We love seeing people working in the places where they're from and gathering that reporting there. But do you have any insights on?
Yeah, I do. So Mark Johnson was somebody who I've talked to and whose work is supported by the Pulitzer Center. He's actually winner of the Pulitzer Prize for other reporting he's done. He's with Milwaukee Journal, and he received. He was speaking with me on a panel one time, and he was relaying the story about how he got one of these reporting trips because he's based in Milwaukee. He's a science reporter there. But he was able to, he covered the university there, or universities there, and he was able to cover one of the professors who was doing some research around disease in Brazil. And I don't know if he covered Zika or something, but he was covering sort of the research and why this is important, sort of studying some of these disease vectors to humans. And so he went with them, or he went down, not with them, but maybe just down to the area that this professor was working at. So he's sort of like starting with his local university and like looking out at where some of this research is being done and why it's important. And then later some of this come up, sort of bubbles up through the national news as a result, because then it becomes maybe a big international story. And yeah, so that sort of understanding that, and then going on beyond sort of understanding what, when you're working with the local collaborators, SEJ's listserv is fantastic, and I've used that a number of times, saying, I've reached out to people, I'm looking for a fixer in Colombia, for instance. And so somebody said, well, actually, I was supposed to do the reporting trip on the Pope, but I got hurt, so I couldn't do it, so this is the guy that took my place, and so he doesn't cover the environment. And I'm like, oh, that's great, because I don't care about that. I care about somebody who knows the country and knows the politics and the reason. And so that is really good. And other things that I've done is, like, I've sat in, I've developed, I've gotten to know people in just all parts of the world, and I learned that this woman had a Women in Sustainability group, and they met for coffee once a month. And she arranged like a meetup at somebody's house in Bogota. And it was a lawyer and a professor and somebody who worked in business and somebody who was a grad student. And all these people, environmental institutions and ecologists, so all of these people doing different kinds of things in the field of sustainability. But I was like, these are kind of like my circle of advisors in the country and the culture. I'm like, what about this? This is sort of like how I'm going with the story. I'm like, oh, no, don't do that. Like, that's, you know, they were actually pointing out the real faults for me in country, and that was great. It saved me a lot of embarrassment. And so I was really happy for that, even though I thought I kind of had the story, but they're like, no. And also some more other sensitivities around the conflict there, and a lot of the legacy of the conflict in the FARC. And, you know, what are some questions to ask people, because they might, if they answer in a certain way, it actually might mean this. It's kind of like if you're from the South and people say, different ways of speaking that mean different things to different where you are. So that was kind of eye-opening for me, and something I will definitely use again and again if I go different places.
I would second all of this. Mm-hmm. The same people who can help put you in touch with trustworthy people that you can work with on the ground are the same people that can also advise you in other ways if they have experience reporting in that area. And I think a lot of times journalists are very generous with one another in terms of helping each other and making the contacts and staying safe. Another thing to be aware of is that the people that we often call fixers are often local journalists themselves. And so it's important to recognize, the important role that they play, the risks that they are subject to that can be different from the risks that we are subject to, and potentially even looking at them as your local journalist partner if they are more than a fixer in that situation. A fixer is like, you know, they'll help coordinate, help make connections. They might drive you, they might connect you to a driver, they might be your driver. So, but they also might be your co-byline, potentially. Mm-hmm. I mean, depending on the circumstance. And it's also, as they're helping to ensure your safety, it's also worthwhile thinking about their safety. They stick around after you leave, and they continue to be local journalists after you leave, and that can be really dangerous depending on where that is.
Go ahead.
No, I'll also just say, in general, we want to see, and this should just be best practices when you're working internationally, that you have thought about the ethics of the work that you're doing, and that you're protecting your sources, you're protecting the local community, and that nothing you say is going to hurt them in the long run. And so it's a big red flag when we feel that somebody has not thought through that on a very sensitive topic or working with a sensitive population.
And that's exactly what I felt, especially in some of the areas where there's a lot of cocaine production. We're going along this hour out of this graveled road town, along a gravel road in the middle of, it's a long way out. And there's this beautiful, bigger than this room, lit and paved gas station with trucks that are filling these big barrels of full of gasoline. Well, they soak the coca leaves in the gasoline, and I want to stop and take a picture of this. And they're like, no, we're not doing this. But it's for that thinking. The people that are driving me, the people that are helping me, they're going to be staying around after I leave. And for me, it's to risk them and stopping to take a photo of this was something I missed. I missed the photo, but I couldn't justify it.
Lisa, you illustrate all of our points with these incredible stories. I'm like, oh, how are people going to remember this? Oh, they're going to picture the coca leaves soaking in gasoline.
I didn't get the story. Yeah. So.
In the spirit of local collaborators, we're going to turn it over to you all now. But please take this first minute to introduce yourself to your neighbor and to ask them what questions they might have about what you've just heard or what questions you have about grant making in general. And in a minute, I will invite speakers to ask questions. Please, if you're an SEJ member, you have priority, and I will be repeating your question in front of the microphone as they're recording this session. All right, 1, 2, 3, go.
All right, I'm going to bring you back now. Thanks very much. Hopefully you at least met someone you haven't met before, and we'll start with the gentleman right here.
Greetings.
And please
Peter.
Project, since we don't have mics.
Peter Gurley, I'm a freelance environment science journalist based in British Columbia, and I'm well experienced with international reporting. I've reported in Bolivia, Libya, China, Japan, all over. But mostly I've done that without getting a journalist visa. And that's the question I wanted to ask you. Only on one trip did I go for a journalist visa, and that's when I was going to North Africa. And I wanted to go to Libya and Algeria. And both it seems a little bit too scary to try and do that without a visa. And I ended up getting the Libyan visa, I think through the sort of connection of some sources, big business sources. But Algeria just did me around, and didn't even answer me. So my assumption has been generally that applying for journalist visa is just a quick route to the trash can. And I'm wondering, when you're going for things like Nat Geo funding and other big grants, are you required to have a journalist visa? Do the organizations have a good track record of getting them? How do you feel about reporting without a journalist visa?
So the question was about getting a journalist visa and whether the process is worth going through, especially in places where they're probably not inclined to give you one, and what grant institutions, which is probably a case-by-case basis, but if you could speak to your particular organization, how they may or may not be able to help you through that process.
It's a good question. On a personal level, I never liked to travel on a journalist visa. I did a lot of reporting in the Middle East as well, and I found it only hindered my work. On an institutional level, it's not something we ask about, and it's probably not something we'd be equipped to assist with, although I think that the affiliation could help you if you felt that that was something that was going to be useful for you.
I only one time did that, and that was when I was in India. And I did that for a number of reasons, but as a woman journalist traveling alone in India, I wanted to have a journalist visa at a time when I was also visiting a number of places that were very kind of research-oriented. And so anyway, I wanted to have that because it gave me entree, actually, to talk to some people that maybe... I don't know, I felt that I might need that. Later I found out that it didn't really matter. I think the biggest thing is if you're reporting from the country and filing stories from the country, that's maybe where it changes. I wasn't there long enough. I mean, I did for that to happen. I think I was home before I did any of my the stories were published. Even though I did a lot of the writing there, so for me that would be the test if I was reporting from those places and filing stories from those places if it needed it. But otherwise, I haven't because I'm also a fellow at with the University of Maryland. I've used my, I'm just here as a visiting faculty type of thing, assistant or researcher or something like that. So I've used that as for the affiliation if there's any questions asked. I've just a educational exchange or something like that. So I felt that it was just maybe better for me to go under the radar because I wasn't filming from that place.
Yeah, I would echo what these guys said.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Brooke Kirschner. I'm with the World Wildlife Fund, and I work with the Media and External Affairs Department. So I have a question. We have scientists going into the field all the time. I work with the freshwater team and our freshwater scientists. And so we always have trips planned, and we're very open to taking journalists with us to cover some of the issues on the ground. And we have a lot of connections on the ground with the local communities, etc. And so I was wondering if that is of interest to journalists to go along with an NGO if we cover it, and what's the most approachable way to let them know that there is this opportunity if there is.
So the question was if journalists would be interested in traveling with NGOs who are working on scientific issues or other issues, depending on the NGO, and what the best way to go about approaching journalists would be.
Can I just kind of, just for a moment, just on behalf of the board, we have to let journalists and SEJ members ask questions first as an SEJ policy, but I mean, feel free to answer that for the future reference.
I will say, and not to speak for journalists, I haven't worked as one for a little while, but usually if you have a free trip, that's like a great incentive. Although I think journalists feel nervous about any whiff of sort of advocacy or if they're going to, you know, be obligated to write in a particular way. And so making sure that there are no strings attached. When I worked at the Aspen Institute, we did really similar trips and also had ones that were for policymakers, but I think for journalists, it's just really about making sure that you're not crossing a line of ensuring that they're going to write to forward your own agenda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would echo that and say that even if the trip isn't free, even if it's just the opportunity to piggyback on a group that's already going and maybe some of the transportation's covered or something, as long as those concerns, you know, there aren't those kinds of concerns, I would say go for it. But that doesn't replace your responsibility in terms of ensuring your safety. You would still want to, even though that can actually help ensure your safety a little bit in a lot of different circumstances, that can be good. You would still want to, you know, take your own independent precautions.
Yeah.
I'm Karen Cornelius. I'm a freelance journalist. I'm very much a generalist when it comes to science and environment, and so I think I would be maybe concerned about how much that might hinder me in terms of if I'm applying for a certain grant and they might say, well, that's not your very specific field, or, you know, is that how much does that matter or not that it's more that I'm more general than have some specific fields related to the money.
So the question is how applying for grants might pigeonhole your reporting. Is that an accurate paraphrase?
Well, I mean, how much less likely or how much difference would it make if whether I'm going to get the grant or not because I don't necessarily specialize in one area and have this long track record in one specific area that's related to that?
Okay, so the question is how does your experience as you're applying to a grant inform your likelihood of getting it?
At National Geographic, if you were a scientist, then we would care very much about, you know, you having a PhD in the topic that you were trying to research. But as a journalist, we care about whether you're a good journalist. And being a generalist is not necessarily a problem as long as it seems like you've really done your research and know the topic. And so we don't have an issue with you being a generalist.
Agreed. Other questions? Yeah.
My name is Diego Ortiz. I come from near Seattle, Chile. And I'm here at SEG with a delegation of Chilean journalists and Chilean journalist students. And there, these grants are not so common, especially when it comes to unexperienced journalists. So my question is, are these institutions and media that you kind of representing willing or looking forward to fund journalists from abroad with interesting, well-planned stories? Or maybe willing to fund creative partnerships with abroad journalists?
Definitely, I know
sorry,
for sure.
Let me rephrase the question. Yeah, it was from a group of Chilean students who say that grant opportunities are perhaps less common when in Chile, and that they have questions about how this could be applied to their experience.
I just wanted to, because I had a conversation with the Pulitzer Center just before coming here, because they just announced a new opportunity for funding reporting on forests, and so they are definitely looking for working with in-country journalists in those regions, so local partners. And so I think you'd actually be in a very prime position to get some of those funds for that type of work if you're reporting on, you know, for instance, what subject areas they are. So that is that's one opportunity.
With us as well, we really prioritize, we have an effort to diversify the voices who are telling these stories. And so the other piece of it that we should mention is for the early career grants, there's a video component where you just have to submit a very simple video. It can be a cell phone video. And if you want to submit that in Spanish or other languages, we have the capacity to assess those as well. So we really are making efforts to bring international voices in.
Yeah, and we also have, often when we have teams of reporters, so if we're pairing like an American journalist with a journalist who's from that, I won't say local necessarily, but from that region or from that country, they're both fellows. And so they're getting paid the same. They're getting like a weekly amount that they're getting paid in the field. And then they're both able to, you know, get paid when that story gets sold somewhere. So I would say the same. And also it can open up other opportunities, because if it's just the American journalist, it's unlikely that they're going to have much luck, you know, writing a piece in Spanish and having it published locally in Chile. So that opens up additional opportunities for the whole project that I think most organizations would be interested in.
Yeah. Question was trends in grant making opportunities and in various topics of news coverage.
I mean, I can only speak for my institution, but it's worth it to look at our strategic areas of interest. It doesn't mean that if you apply outside of those that we wouldn't fund it, but it's another one of those extra credit pieces. And so looking at conservation, environmentalism and these issues is very potent, I think, for a lot of people, especially right now. I actually just looked at a graph, and it said that funding trends for journalism are very much focused on environmental journalism. So that's a good thing for all of us here, I think.
Yeah, I think there is going to be more money coming in for climate change. I don't think it's going to get less. I think it's just going to get more.
Yeah, on the end.
Hi, I'm Samantha Fields. I'm currently a fellow through Ground Truth based at WCAI Public Radio on Cape Cod doing climate reporting. And my question is mostly for Lisa, although if the Rachels have thoughts on this too, I'm very open. But I'm curious how, when you're based here in the U.S. and you're applying for these grants to do stories abroad, how you're finding stories and pre-reporting them to the degree that you feel comfortable applying for a grant to go to Colombia or somewhere where you maybe haven't been on the ground. I just always find that a little bit daunting.
That's
so. Sorry, I'm going to rephrase the question. Yes. So the question was on
you're on it.
How to pre-report international stories before you receive funding.
Yeah. That's a really great question, and I do a lot of pre-reporting. I do it in a number of ways. It's often with a university-affiliated somebody I meet, and I find that to be a crucial contact because they're always convening different people from around the world or having different meetings and conferences and combinations of things that I would have never thought existed, right? It's always a surprise, and that to me is interesting. Proximity to Washington, D.C. is helpful because people from all over the world come there to talk around panels and things, and so the Wilson Center, for instance, has a lot of people coming together. But for you, everybody, you know, they're all almost online, so you can watch them online. I'm drawing a blank, but there are a number of them. The Inter-American Dialogue also has for Latin America their pieces online, and then they have them archived on video, so you get to see what people are doing in country, and so you can get some context, and you can follow up with them later. Hey, I saw you talking here, and let me ask you about this piece. The State Department and USAID also has science. To send me, there are people who are scientists who take a sabbatical, and one of the things that they may do is to be attached to a specific unit at the State Department. And this is how I got some of the story ideas for my reporting in Columbia. A reporter or a professor of, she's a professor of biology, and so she was giving me some of these examples of some of the biology program, research program she was setting up in Columbia. I didn't actually report on her work, but it gave me entree, and she interested. These are all the people that are leading this work and that you might want to talk to. So I talked to them, and then they, of course, led to more people, and then that continued to branch out. So that, to me, is some of the ways I've found these building blocks for stories, you know, conferences, scientific papers, reading on that. And so I usually don't report about what the specific finding is, but I start to realize, okay, there's lots coming out around, I don't know, urban resilience, and so what's happening here? And then I kind of do a little bit of reverse engineering to figure out who the people are.
I'll also just say, obviously, I'm sure you do this, but doing your due diligence to see what has been written about, particularly at the institution or outlet where you're pitching your idea. Because if you say you want to do something on, I don't know, spider monkeys, and we're like, we just published something on that, that's sort of a non-starter. And then also, if you do have any particular language skills, it helps make the case that you're not going to just sort of jump in and be lost. So choosing a place where you speak the language is quite helpful.
One of the things I want to talk about the language as well. I've used translators a lot, and I've also used, sometimes I'll be traveling with somebody, for instance, somebody who's a researcher or a research team for part, like one of the days, and they'll do some translating for me because I wouldn't necessarily need a translator the whole day, but like one or two stops. But they get tired. If that's not their job, and you're hearing something from the person you're interviewing, and then the translator says, "Oh, he said da da da," but he's like, this person talked for 5 minutes, right? So I always record it, and I try to think, okay, is this something that I might want to use in my story? And then I have somebody else sort of listen to that piece and verify what the translation was. Because there were times like I met up at the hotel pool or sort of like on the patio after a trip. It was with post-conflict minister who was sort of doing some work in the region where I was. I would never have gotten him had I not sort of just bumped into him at my hotel and heard him talking a little bit, and then found somebody to translate and ask. And he wanted to go on the record and answer questions, and so. But those people can be also fatigued because it's a lot of work to translate. So just an understanding that that can be an issue as well.
All right, so we have time for one or two more questions. So we'll take you two, and we'll start with you.
I have a question about how, for both Rachels, how pulling these grants work. Are you giving them money in advance of travel, or do you give it after publication somewhere? I know that varies a lot from place to place. So
the question was how at your particular grant-making institution the money works.
So for us, the travel would be, like, we would probably buy the tickets and things like that. We'd be working closely with you on, you know, booking whatever the, you know, whatever you needed for being in the field. And then we also pay our reporters while they're in the field. So, you know, there would be, like, a weekly amount. And then, you know, you also have the opportunity then to sell your story. And we work closely with the reporters on publishing the stories, landing the stories in places, and trying to get you paid for them. Sometimes outlets, I don't want to say this, like, this is certainly not a, you know, true in general, but because the reporters have already been paid, essentially, like, through the fellowship program, sometimes they're willing to publish stories, like, in additional places without being paid, just to get more reach for the story. So, obviously, it's great when they can get paid, but it's not always the case. It's typically the case, especially if it's, like, a reputable publication, or not reputable, but a bigger publication that can afford to pay. There's some sort of, I want to say our contract has something funny in it where it's like, if you get paid some exorbitant amount, which I don't think has ever happened, but if you get paid some kind of outrageous, crazy amount, there would be potentially some cost sharing where some of the expense of the fellowship might end up being covered by that. But I would say generally it's just you get paid in the field, all of your expenses get paid, and then you get paid for your story.
Yeah, so we pay everybody up front. My caveat to that is to say that our grant-making process is peer-reviewed because it's part of this scientific grant-making process, so it takes a while. So we tell people to expect, and sometimes it takes less time, but to plan for it to take 6 months from when you apply for funding to when you get the money in your pocket. And so we ask you to make your travel dates in accordance to that. But everything is paid up front. And then I should also mention that currently we have it so that you can pay, we'll cover any travel. We cover a number of things, including dependent care. But you can pay yourself up to 20% of the total grant as a stipend if you're working as a freelancer. That may be changing in the coming months, but it's not for sure yet. So.
And yeah. One final note on that, nobody has asked a question about this, but make sure that you're clear with your grant-making organization how they're reporting your grant to the IRS. Taxes are a thing that you should know how they're planning on doing it so that you can do the same. And if you don't, it will come back to haunt you. Not that I'm speaking from personal experience. All right, yeah.
Hi, I'm Alejandra, and I'm from Chile, too. You talk about the importance of measuring the impact that your work might have and how that could be like sort of a bonus when applying. So I wanted to know if you could give us some advice on how to actually measure these impacts. Is it only by social media or how?
It's a topic dear to my heart. there's one of the pieces of that is to actually have thought about what impact might happen through your work and thinking about how you might measure that. So maybe you say, "There, I want to conduct a survey among a group of people who may have seen my work to see how their opinions may change." There are a number of really great resources, so I won't give you a whole class on how to do this, but certainly measuring on social media is useful, but more and more we're realizing we don't really know what likes mean and or what shares mean and what actually moves people to action. The Walton Family Foundation has put together a number of resources on how to do this. It's really simple and helpful. But it's really about setting up a question at the very beginning that says, when somebody reads this article or sees these photographs, what do I think or perhaps hope they might do? And I know that's sometimes a scary way for a journalist to be thinking. And so I wanted people to stay within their comfort zones. But also, I think particularly environmental journalists do this work because we care about these issues. And so setting up that question in advance and then thinking about how you might understand the answer to that. It's very easy when you see that a law has changed because of your work, which is not uncommon. Or if you see a congressman or woman holding up a photograph you took to make a case, those are things we want to see in your final report. If that's the case, but it's not always something you can plan for. But as much as you can show that you've planned for it, we appreciate that.
One of the things that I do with the Pulitzer Center is I, because I give so many talks about my work, I've been counting, like, so I should count how many people there are in this room, and I count in minutes, you know. So I, you know, spoke about this subject to, you know, 2,000 people over the course of, you know, 4 hours this year or something like that. I don't know, something like that. So providing some time frame and some, like, what's that outreach? Or if I was on the radio talking about the work or did a podcast speaking about it. So that's sort of an additional piece. In addition to the written piece, the impact is that I was invited to speak. I also get invited to speak at various think tanks in Washington, D.C. So if you become then the expert on this subject and you can advise, you provide advice, this is what I saw on the ground, and this is my reporting sort of led me to think and believe or whatever, and sort of this is what I wrote about. So that has been some sort of anecdotal information I've been able to share to report back on that work.
Or if people readers reach out to you, those are things that we want you to be thinking about and measuring as well.
I don't think there's any downside to reaching out to whatever outlet publishes your work, whether you actually work there or whether you're a freelancer, and trying to get the metrics for your work. It can be, so maybe for the next grant that you apply to, it might be useful to know that previous reporting that you did or that previous grant that you got, you know, reached this many people. Those metrics are typically private, but I would say that most news organizations would be happy to share them with you because it's your story, because you're not going to be, like, broadcasting those metrics. You're going to be using them, you know, for your own purposes. So another thing I'd suggest is, and this is something that I hadn't really done before, but the Mass Humanities, which was one of the funders of that podcast season, really encouraged, which is public community events around the work can be so cool to really, you know, convene a group of people to discuss what the reporting was. And, you know, so it's not boring. It can be really dynamic. I mean, we had, like, you know, video and performance and all these kind of cool things that the community came together around. And because our reporting was around immigrants and music, it was, I don't want to say it was a unique opportunity, but it was a special opportunity for that particular community to come together and talk about culture and music. And the response from those community events was tremendous. People were like, oh my God, we should get together and do this more often. This is amazing. And for our culminating event, because we had like 4 different community events and the last one was larger and a more general audience, we actually gave people surveys, which gets to this idea of, you know, what was the impact of the work kind of on a sort of on an individual level with people.
Great. Well, you're all late for coffee, so we're going to wrap up now, but thank you for coming, and I'm sure these guys wouldn't mind sticking around for a few minutes. If you have any questions, please feel free to come up.